right. We only have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket, so we will proceed through both of them. And if the clerk will please announce counsel for the first case, Roe versus State. All right, Mr. Houghton.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel. Your Honor, to boil this case down, I think what we're looking at, and I think the issue that this court is going to need to decide is going to be an issue of waiver and whether the failure of trial counsel to object to this additional evidence or additional expert testimony in this case was effective or should be effective. And I think that's probably where we boil all of this case down to. As the court is aware, this is a case based upon a plea of guilty to a third-degree felony DWI. And the case was then submitted to the jury for punishment. And as a result of that submission to the jury gave the defendant 2 years a two-year sentence in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. But this case and the question in this case revolves around the expert testimony that was provided in rebuttal on the during the punishment phase of this trial. And the rebuttal evidence was provided by the technical supervisor in that case and was provided in response to an assertion that the appellant made during his testimony in the case that he had had two drinks and one other drink that was never, I guess, disclosed or discussed during the trial. I was not counsel at trial. In any event, on a rebuttal, the technical supervisor was called upon to render some testimony and provide testimony regarding retrograde extrapolation. There was an objection lodged by defense counsel as to that testimony. They conducted a hearing outside the presence of the jury. And during the course of that hearing, before the court only and not the jury, they discussed two questions that the expert would be called upon to answer. One was, using retrograde extrapolation, what would his, you know, alcohol level been at the time he was driving? And then the second question was, would it have been possible for him to get to that level having had only two drinks? I mean, directly in rebuttal to his testimony before the jury. And the court heard that testimony. The court weighed that the factors that were required of it. There was no objection specifically at this point by defense counsel. And so the jury was brought back in, and questioning proceeded with the expert on the stand, and he went through, again, that classic retrograde testimony. He provided that. He was asked the question, could Mr. Roe have only had two drinks and had this level of alcohol in his system? And the answer was no. But then, Your Honors, he went on to testify even further than that, and they began to do sort of the reverse, a reverse retrograde extrapolation, to go back and to try and testify to the jury how many drinks he had. And his testimony at this point, without objection from trial counsel, was that the expert believed he had 10 to 13 drinks in order to get to that level of alcohol content in his system. Well, certainly that goes beyond the expertise of the technical supervisor. We have certainly some literature, even though there's still experts on both sides of the issue with regard to retrograde extrapolation. We have a sufficient number of experts that provide that, you know, that's good science, that's reliable enough to put before the jury for the jury to aid the jury in its decision here. And certainly in this case, it would have been right on point to use it to say two drinks is not reasonable, or two drinks is not certainly not even likely what he had to get to this level. But then to use it to try and go in the reverse and say how many drinks he had, which would have had him drinking during the time he was driving the vehicle, was just put in not to rebut his testimony, but really to inflame this jury. And one of the problems that Mr. Roe was striving to get probation in this case, and we see from the transcript at least that was a consideration for the jury, because the jury sent out a note during its deliberation, it's part of the record, that what happens if he violates the terms of his probation. They were clearly thinking about that as a possible sentence in this case. But this testimony here would have been sufficient enough to have inflamed the jury and caused the jury to not give him probation, but to give him a prison term. But
if there's no objection, how is it not waived?
Your Honor, my argument...
Not waived, I guess. How is it preserved?
I suppose, Your Honor, my argument is that the court has a gatekeeping function to ensure that the defendant gets a fair trial and that the evidence that's presented before the jury is reliable evidence, even in the punishment phase. And I understand that the standards relax somewhat for punishment-only phases. But the judge still has an obligation as a gatekeeper to ensure that the evidence that's put before the jury is good evidence, notwithstanding trial counsel's failure to object. Now, I also think that the district attorney's office has an obligation to only present good evidence. And my problem in this case, and I think the problem that the court would have with this, is that clearly the record shows that in the voir dire hearing, outside of the presence of the jury, they only went through the first two questions. When we get back into live testimony in front of the jury, all of a sudden we throw the third question out. The skunk is out. And
you didn't raise ineffective assistance.
No, Your Honor.
There was nothing in the motion. There was no motion for new trial raising ineffective assistance that would allow any discussion of this. I agree. I think the state does have an obligation to limit the offer of evidence they know is inadmissible, but the state also has the opportunity to try to push the bounds of the law, and it's we have an adversarial system. There's got to be an objection. I mean, unless you want the trial court trying everybody's case for them.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor. I also understand that in the context of an actual trial, one of the articles that was recited in speaking about retrograde extrapolation and the science of it made reference to the fact that the science of retrograde extrapolation is kind of easy in the laboratory. It's difficult in real life in these cases. And the same is kind of true about the trial, because what happens in the trial is counsel's got to make that decision. Do I raise this objection in front of the jury, draw the attention to it, and potentially do more damage to my client? It would be similar to me raising a judge, I'd like to offer a polygraph into evidence in front of a jury. Well, the jury's already...
You can't do that because you know it's not admissible.
I can't do it. But I've already created the problem for counsel on the other side. I've already created the impression with the jury. And defense counsel's in a position of not compounding that problem by raising the objection, entering into this conflict in front of the jury. And so I think there is a greater obligation on the part of the state to make sure that they don't put evidence in front of the jury that they know or reasonably should know is not admissible. And there's no finding, certainly in this record, and I've not been able to find any elsewhere, that provides that type of analysis by a retrograde expert is admissible anywhere. The science doesn't back it up. It's not like trying to do the reverse of an interest calculation. I mean, numbers are what they are, but human physiology and that science of how the body processes alcohol is a very different matter, and there's no science to say that you can go back and make a determination of how many drinks a person had. So because there was no foundation or basis for getting that testimony in, certainly the state knew that they shouldn't put it in. And they should have raised it in the voir dire. I wouldn't be as suspicious of them just throwing it out there after the voir dire, except there was extensive voir dire on this expert testimony. And so if there is ever a time to ask, this is the question. Does the court have an obligation over and above defense counsel's obligation to make an objection to act as a gatekeeper and to make sure that testimony or that evidence that's not admissible doesn't get into trial. And I understand Your Honor's concerns. You don't want the judge having to step in and take over for defense counsel. Defense counsel may have perfectly good reasons for not raising that objection. They may. Or they may just find themselves in a position where strategically they have to pick their poison, and they shouldn't be put in that position, certainly when we have expert testimony and the state has an opportunity to raise it to the court outside the presence of the jury and get a ruling on it.
Okay, let me ask you this. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Now, if the what is the foundation that you believe the court should have applied before allowing the third question?
It would have been the same foundation that the court had to consider for the first two questions.
Okay, but that was considered in the hearing, the voir dire outside the presence, and if the court determined that the witness was qualified in terms of testifying about the science of the retrograde extrapolation, then would it be your position that every question that was going to be asked in front of the jury has to be raised in the voir dire hearing?
No, Your Honor, but that was a different finding. That was a distinct opinion that was being offered. I do think each opinion that an expert is going to raise should be put in front of the court in that voir dire process. And at least at that point, defense counsel could have raised an objection to the evidence outside of the hearing of the jury. And then certainly there wouldn't be a waiver issue here, but certainly counsel wouldn't have been put to that very difficult decision.
I'm looking at page 12 of the appellant's brief, in which there is a recitation on the bottom of the page about the assumptions that were to be asked in a basic level of trying to arrive at the physiology and the information to be given to the expert in order to prepare to make the extrapolation. And if the court were to hear those kinds of items laid as a foundation for the asking of an expert opinion as to the effect of alcohol on that person, how is it different that he's asking for a statement in the negative that it couldn't have been from just two drinks, and to a statement in the positive that it was more than two drinks, to wit, in my opinion, 10 or 13? I don't understand how that could be a gatekeeping function that the court could address at the voir dire hearing.
Your Honor, an affirmative opinion that says 10 to 13 drinks is certainly a far cry from it couldn't have been two. And the reason that I think we have a problem, retrograde is taking it from the factors moving forward in time to give us an estimate of what the expert thinks his alcohol content would have been.
Yes.
But there's no science that takes us from alcohol content, considering some of those factors, backwards the other way. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to take factors that we put together to come to this number, and we're trying to do a mathematical equation to go the other way.
I understand your position. Thank you for answering my question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So to what extent, then, are we gatekeepers, and to what extent are we supposed to go out and learn the difference between retrograde extrapolation, which has been recognized, and whatever this is that they offered that isn't retrograde, it's something else? To what extent now do we have to go out and become gatekeepers and learn about this stuff?
Certainly, Your Honor, at least to the extent that the court has to evaluate the factors that you would under the gatekeeping factors before any of the scientific evidence comes in to play at trial. At least if there's an evaluation done, the court can agree or disagree that they've satisfied the conditions of admitting that evidence.
So you're saying that since this has not been recognized as sound science, since it's a novel science in the same category as junk science until it's proven to be respectable science, that it should be treated as junk science until the proponent of the evidence proves that it's sound science by offering the scientific basis for this? And
that's correct, Your Honor. There has to be something more than just, I'm offering a third opinion, and this is what my opinion is.
Okay.
And that's, I think that's all I've got in my time's out.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Houghton.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Nathan Miller. I'm here on behalf of the state. I'm actually appearing for Forrest Beadle, who's in trial up in Denton today. I think the state's brief not only correctly identifies the issues this case presents, but it also addresses them in the order I think the analysis requires. Mr. Houghton, I think, hit it on the head in the beginning. This case is about preservation. I don't know how we get over that hurdle in this case, and I'd like to go through the issues in that same order. And I'd ask the court to affirm for three reasons. The first, because appellant has failed to preserve the alleged error in this case. The second, because the trial court did not abuse its discretion in allowing this retrograde testimony.
But it's not retrograde. That's the whole point.
Your Honor, it's not the classic retrograde extrapolation question that MATA and its progeny dealt with, but it is a form of retrograde extrapolation in that it uses the same factors, blood alcohol concentration, body mass, and volume of drinks to determine what the standard number of drinks would be.
What was the evidence that all the alcohol was consumed in 1 hour?
Well, the evidence came through, to put this kind of into trial perspective, there was testimony, there was evidence on the videotape that the appellant stated to the officer that night about his drinking. He stated that he had two drinks from 10 p.m. to 11 p.m., and he didn't drink anymore. When the state called Mr. Robinson and his case in chief, basically just called him to lay the predicate for and introduce the breath test results, which were 0.21. It wasn't until after the appellant testified in the defense case in chief, and he testified as to, you know, when he was drinking, what exactly he was drinking, his weight, all that stuff came out on cross-examination and allowed the state to then recall Robinson to perform this retrograde extrapolation. So the facts came out then as to when he was drinking. He again stated that he only had two drinks from 10 to 11. Obviously, that's impossible, as Robinson explained. He could not have only had two drinks, that it would have been much more likely for him to have 10 to 13, and he did that using a formula that's recognized by him and the scientific community. While it has not been evaluated by maybe a court of appeals or the court of criminal appeals, such
but
as MATA.
What was the evidence that it was that it's been recognized by the scientific community?
There wasn't any, and the reason there wasn't any is because defense did not object in the 702 hearing. Had they objected, the state would then have been required to go through the 705 requirements, to go through Robinson's qualifications to give that testimony, and then also to address the reliability of that type of science, the methodology behind it. The state, and that's the whole purpose of 33.1 and the requirement that an objection be lodged in a 702 hearing. I understand Mr. Houghton's concern that defense attorneys may not want to object in front of the jury. It may be strategy, but that's exactly why we have the 702 hearing. If they were to object, then the court could address that objection, make a ruling, and that does not have to be done again in front of the jury. So that's the protection there for defense.
So you're not asking us to go out on a limb and rule this is good science?
Certainly not.
You're just asking us to find the issue hasn't been preserved.
Exactly. This is not the proper case in which the court should be asked to do that. Had the objection been made and had Robinson's testimony not reached the level of 705 requirements, I think this might be the case to do that. I don't know that it would be because this is a punishment. This was a punishment case. So, you know, what comes into evidence is a little more
loose.
It's a little more loose than it would have been had it been guilt innocence. Under Murphy, it would have been about policy rather than 401 and so forth, but this certainly isn't the case. When objections aren't clear and legal issues aren't obvious, it doesn't serve the purpose of the contemporaneous objection rule for an appellate court like this to review the merits of a forfeitable issue basically for the first time on appeal. And that's what appellant is asking this court to do today. If you look at page 174 of the record, you can see this 702 hearing. The prosecutor asked Mr. Robinson, I guess his qualifications and the reliability of what he was going to say came out in his case in chief when he was talking about his credentials. You know, he's a 20 years experience with the breath testing program in Dallas, his degrees in zoology and chemistry. All of this came out in direct. In the 702 hearing, it was specifically related to the retrograde testimony. So he went through kind of his experience doing that and then the reliability, and he kind of went through the factors under MATA. The court then made its ruling, overruled the objection by defense, and found that he was qualified and the methodology was reliable. He was going to allow the retrograde testimony. Then the prosecutor said, Your Honor, I have one more question I'd like to ask of Mr. Robinson. I don't know if Denver, appellant's trial attorney, is going to have a problem with it. Put him on notice there. The court said, go ahead, and the prosecutor then asked, is it possible for a 150-pound man to be at a .22 after having only consumed two drinks? The answer, of course, was no. The court then asked appellant's trial attorney, do you object to that? And the appellant's attorney said, no. So I think that would have been, obviously, the proper time to raise an objection and to ask the court to go into the qualifications and reliability as it relates to this different kind of retrograde extrapolation. It wasn't done here, so to say that this wasn't reliable and wasn't qualified, I don't think the state had a chance that really to get there in this case. Going into, without addressing the preservation issue and just going into the junk science argument, it's obvious that Robinson was qualified to give this testimony. I think appellant's brief on page 10 basically stipulates to his qualifications. I mean, he's had 20 years experience and he's done this retrograde extrapolation hundreds, if not thousands of times in that time. There's also been no objection to the scope of the 702 hearing or the method in which it was done. So I think the real issue here is just whether this is a recognized form of science. I don't know that any court really in this state has addressed this particularly and gone through like MATA did. But we've attached an article as Appendix A. I know it wasn't in the record at trial, but in looking at that on page 285 of this article, which was cited by the MATA court and was relied on by Terry Robinson in doing this type of extrapolation. This extrapolation uses much the same factors that retrograde, the classic form, uses. And basically, as that article explains, there are three parameters that are interleaked, and they are body mass, the volume or number of drinks absorbed in the system, and blood alcohol level. And as the article explains, if any two of those are known, the third one can be calculated based on these recognized pharmacokinetic principles.
That assumes a properly functioning liver. I mean, we're talking averages. We're talking the average person. So this fellow could have been drinking all night long. He could have not had that much in the last hour or in the hour when he was driving. He could have had it all night long, but because of the condition of his body, because of consumption of food or other things, it could have affected the rate of absorption. So and we're just talking averages and guesses and speculation at this point, but it was admitted by agreement. Isn't that the end of the story? It was admitted by agreement. Do you have any objection? No objection. Do you have any problem with this? No, I don't have any problem with it. It's admitted by agreement. And isn't that really the end of the inquiry?
I think it is, Your Honor. I think you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, there was no objection to it. The state wasn't put on notice and didn't really get to go into the science and methodology behind this calculation, which Mr. Robinson did. So I don't know how we get past the waiver or failure to preserve issue in this case. I was just simply going forward and looking at this as a science and something that the state offered. I think Justice Meyer hit it on the head, too. I mean, you have these two questions asked. One in the 702 hearing, that is it possible to have reached this level based on two drinks or after having only two drinks? And then the second question, well, how much would it have taken, 10 to 13? You can't answer the second question, the 10 to 13, or rather you can't answer the first question without answering the second. And that's what happened here. When the question was asked of Mr. Robinson, is it possible to have only consumed two drinks? He had to do that calculation, which he does. He had to take what he knew, which was the body mass, the 150 pounds, and then the blood alcohol level.
Mr. Miller, we're talking about in these questions that are set out in your brief on page 16 and 17. We're talking about standard drinks.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then there is a what they're calling a standard drink here. We're talking about consumption of liquor, 1 1/4 ounce in a drink. But then talking about calculations of the quantity of blood alcohol and the blood alcohol content at a given time, the question is asked and answered, then really and truly you can't tell about how many drinks of 10 to 13 standard drinks, what happens if you're putting five shots in one glass.
And the same question was asked of Mr. Robinson on cross-examination after the 702 hearing. Appellant's trial attorney did ask him, well, you say two drinks. I mean, you could put one shot of whiskey or whatever he was drinking in that drink, or you could put two or three, right? And he agreed with him. Certainly, you know, two drinks, that could be two normal standard drinks, as he testified what a standard drink was. He did testify to that in front of the jury.
Well, the critical predicate in evaluating the admissibility of the opinion testimony would have to be going to the actual physiology of the defendant in terms of his weight, what he had eaten, how long he'd been drinking, matters of that kind. And if you're extrapolating to try to start at a point in time and then to consider what might have happened 1 hour before that is one thing. And then if you're not looking at just 1 hour, then you really can't tell over what period of time the alcohol was put into the system to arrive at the blood alcohol content of 2.1.
And that's exactly Mata's concern there. I mean, the expert has to recognize the inherent difficulty in this science, and also that he has to assume certain things. The state asks the expert to assume basically what comes out on the video or on cross-examination of a defendant. He gives this expert these assumptions. Assume for me that he had only been drinking from 10 to 11, that he was this blood alcohol concentration at this time, and the expert then does the retrograde extrapolation. Certainly, those assumptions could be wrong if the defendant was either lying, which is not uncommon to, you know, it's alcohol volume is notoriously inaccurate coming from a defendant's mouth on the roadside and oftentimes in court. So these assumptions are just assumptions. But certainly the jury heard the testimony of the defendant before Robinson testified. So, you know, if they don't believe it, they don't believe it. I think that was the state's whole point in recalling him, was to contradict the fact that he'd only had two drinks. And we have a glaring number here, a blood alcohol concentration of nearly three times the legal limit. So it was almost a joke to say that he only had two drinks. And I think that was the state's whole point. 10 to 13, you know, if the drinks were triples or quadruples, maybe, but certainly the jury could hear that testimony and put two and two together as we can do. So, but without addressing the preservation issue, without addressing the merits of the junk science argument, there's also the harmful error issue here, and that's my third point. I think under 44.2B, you've got to look at this testimony in the context of the entire record. We've got a fellow who had two recent DWI convictions. The jury heard testimony that the first time up in Denton County, he got probation and was revoked for violating committing a new offense. The second DWI conviction down here in Tarrant County, he didn't even get probation. He just served jail time. So the jury, in giving him the 2 years, I think was based not only on his past criminal history with DWI, but also the egregious nature of this offense. They saw the video. They saw and heard the breath test results in this case, nearly three times the legal limit. They saw and heard a man who still stuck to two drinks and seemed not to want to give up anything at trial. I don't think it's kind of a leap to go and then say, well, their jury didn't give probation. They gave the minimum 2 years simply because he lied about the number of drinks that he had. They could have looked to a number of things in the record that is here, and we can see to back that up. It wasn't a 10-year.
Wasn't there some inconsistency in the defendant's testimony about two versus three drinks?
Yes, Your Honor. He did testify that he had three drinks on direct.
On direct, okay.
On cross, he went back to two, which was what he said on the video as well. So okay. Two or three, either way, he's a 0.22. And I think the jury, I see that my time is up. I think the jury looked at all of that, looked at his priors, looked at the egregious nature of this offense, and certainly relied on all of it rather than this one statement by Mr. Robinson. Thank you.
I'm sorry, what was your last name again?
Miller.
Miller. Oh, I should remember that.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Houghton.
Thank you. Just be very brief. One of the things that I want to just highlight here is that Mr. Rowe had already conceded that he was intoxicated when he was driving. So that really wouldn't have been something that the jury, that would have necessarily inflamed the jury. His estimate for what he had to drink that evening is probably not reliable because he was intoxicated. So I think juries kind of take that kind of evidence for what it's worth. But when you throw out that additional factor that, well, you had 10 to 13 drinks, that's something that was thrown out for no reason other than just to inflame the jury and to cause the jury not to consider probation. To say that they didn't, they certainly weren't even going to consider probation in this case because of his prior history doesn't make any sense in light of their note that they sent to the court. What happens if he violates a term or condition of his probation? So they were clearly considering a probation sentence in this case. I don't think there's any question. Without knowing how seriously they were considering, we can't know any of that, but we do know that that was a consideration. They didn't just shelve that. They didn't just set that aside after having heard all the evidence in this case. to say, now we certainly, just again, highlight, there was no objection to their experts' qualifications to testify to what he was to testify to, and that is the retrograde extrapolation. And certainly to even be able to testify to whether or not this defendant, it's accurate to say that he only had two drinks to end up with this result. There was no objection to his qualifications to say that because counsel didn't believe, and we certainly haven't even raised it here, that he wasn't qualified to answer those questions. Our narrow issue for the court is just on that third question. Now, on the third question, he says that after we had the voir dire before the court only, then we get back in front of the jury, and he asked counsel right in front of the jury, can I ask this question? Is that question okay?
And that was in front of the jury?
In front of the jury is my recollection of that of what happened, what I see in the transcript. So it puts counsel in that same very difficult position. Am I going to be hiding the ball from the jury, as jurors tend to think we do anyway, or am I going to just have to let this go and try and limit my damage otherwise? That was the difficult decision that counsel was put in, and I would urge to the court that that gatekeeping obligation fell heavily on the court, certainly fell on the prosecution not to go there. They have an obligation to do justice, not just to zealously represent the state. And I do understand they should be pushing the boundaries of the law, but pushing the boundaries of the law certainly within good faith. And it would have been appropriate then to have given trial counsel an opportunity to raise that objection when they were talking about it in that hearing outside of the presence of the jury.
Mr. Houghton, on page 14 of your brief, there is a quote that deals with the assumption that the first drink was at 10 p.m. and the last drink at 11. From your reading of the transcript, was that merely an assumption or was there evidence to the jury that the first drink was at 10 and the last drink was at 11? Or was
that merely
an assumption on the part of the prosecution?
I don't believe it was a pure assumption. I think there was some evidence to support that assumption, as there should have been, during the presentation of evidence.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Houghton.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller, Mr. Orbison, we appreciate you coming today. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing on this case. Your case is submitted, and you are excused. Thank you.